I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a young man raised in the poor section of Dallas's Oak Cliff neighborhood ponders the contradictions of his life so far. Casey Gerald grew up with a gift for giving speeches and for playing football that got him to Yale on a full scholarship. He went to work on Wall Street and in Washington. He earned a Harvard MBA and founded an influential nonprofit. Gerald also grew up with a drug-addicted father and a mother who disappeared from his life, also with the crushing sense that God couldn't love him because he was gay. Those experiences are a part of who he is as well. We'll talk with Gerald about the ways he's been defined by his surroundings, even as he's been different from the people who surrounded him. Our conversation starts after a short break. How do you make sense of a life full of contradictions when that life is still in progress? Casey Gerald grew up the son of a university-educated father, and he grew up poor, not least because his dad got addicted to the drugs he was given to play college football when he was injured. Gerald loved his mother, but she disappeared from his life for years. Gerald grew up deeply religious. As a 12-year-old in 1999, he stayed up with his church expecting the world to end at the turn of the millennium. He also grew up convinced he was a sinner because he was gay. Gerald's intelligence, his hard work, and his athletic ability earned him a scholarship to Yale. But when he arrived, he wasn't convinced he belonged. He founded the Yale Black Men's Union to spare other students that doubt. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Casey Gerald's new memoir embraces and probes the contradictions in his life without trying to fit them neatly into the standard narrative of a kid from the wrong side of the tracks who succeeded against the odds. The book is called There Will Be No Miracles Here. Casey Gerald joins us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. And just a warning, this interview contains a word that some listeners might find offensive. Casey, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. So good to talk to you.
You say that your father was the greatest man you had ever known, his father was the greatest man he had ever known, and that was most likely the root of all the evil inside each of you. What do you mean by that?
Well, first off, I mean I love that sentence.
Yeah, you know, I do too.
At base, my job as a writer is just to make very good sentences. Aside from that, you know, my father is considered by many to be the greatest, one of the greatest high school football players in the history of the state of Texas. You know, at the time when he was at South Oak Cliff High School, which I should say was on the right side of the tracks, I'm always confused by this language of the wrong side of the tracks. I'd consider Oak Cliff to be the right side of the tracks.
Fair
actually,
enough.
For my money. At the time when he was a quarterback at Ohio State, and even on through the 80s, South Oak Cliff had sent more players to the NFL than any high school in the country. That was according to former Mayor Laura Miller. And he goes off to play football at Ohio State for Woody Hayes. He was second black quarterback in the history of the program. What's funny and what I found in writing the book was that the year he went off to college as this sort of nationally celebrated athlete, his father, Cornelius Gerald, founded the second location of his church, making him one of the first black preachers in Dallas to oversee two locations, and also making my father's historic journey the second most important thing to happen in his family that year. I mean, that's a really fantastically awful conundrum to find yourself in, you know. And so I think in a lot of ways, what I'm trying to do here is untangle all of the ways we are happened to and happening on other people, both as individuals and also as a country.
What was your dad like to grow up with?
It depends on when you're talking about. Early on, I lived in Columbus, and I say when I wasn't trying to overthrow him and he wasn't trying to keep me alive, I had threatened to commit suicide when I was 7 or 8. We had had a disagreement about something that he was probably right about, and I found this to be intolerable. So I ran and I said, I'll just have to kill myself to get some freedom around here. And I ran and found my Sega Genesis cord and wrapped it around my neck. And he was still pretty athletic at that time, so he caught me pretty quickly and prevented me from getting my revenge. But anyway, my father was really an incredible person, you know. And I think, you know, what was so important in this book was to see that he was much more than the story that was told about him when I was a kid. You know, when I was in sixth grade, the front page of the Dallas Morning News had him on the cover. Said, once the pride of Texas, South Oak Cliff star, found his life sacked by drugs and bad decisions. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. The first time he took cocaine was before the Orange Bowl game in 1977. He was 20 years old. He had broken his back earlier that year, and Woody Hayes wanted him to play, and he wanted to play. And so a guy comes and offers him cocaine, and he takes it, and he plays in this game. He's the MVP. It's the greatest game of his life, and he never plays again without using, and things spiral from there. And so what I really try to do with my father and with this book is to trouble the sort of villain hero narratives that we get, whether it's for people who actually have caused us a hell of a lot of problems or for people we don't even hardly know, like George W. Bush, who I talk about later on in the book.
Let's go back to Laura Miller, who you mentioned would go on to be the mayor of Dallas when you were in high school. She was kind of a muckraking journalist when your father spent time with her, and you two had sort of parallel experiences with her.
I wouldn't say parallel. She was focused on him and kind of ignoring me. Mm. I mean, rightfully so. She was the mayor by the time I met her. I don't know why, she had to put up with me shadowing her for a day. This was one of the many programs that Dallas has. I write in the book that there are these programs Dallas has to convince city leaders that beneath the stench of failure, there is at least a fine mist of success. And so when I was a senior, I was chosen to be mayor of the day. Mayor for the Day, which is a program by which one student from every high school, public high school in Dallas, was chosen to go down and shadow the mayor for the day. And it turns out Laura Miller had many years ago, before I was even born, the year before I was born, shadowed my father and tried to really use his story as a parable for the ways in which the system of high school and college football really chews young men up and spits them out and blames it all on them. And this book has a lot to say about that, I hope.
Hmm. You also talk about, football being about both sex and power, especially as manifested in Texas high schools.
Yeah. Well, that's not that he can sue me, but that's an Oscar Wilde quote, so I want to give him credit. He says, everything in life is about sex, except sex. Sex is about power. And Texas high school football, I'd say, is about both. You know, in a lot of ways, this book is a sports book. I thought it was very important, actually, to write from the perspective of somebody who had played the sport. You know, so many sports books, especially now, very rightfully so, are so critical of this game that means so much to so many of us, even though we have suffered mightily for it, physically and otherwise. It's a beautiful, beautiful experience, transcendent experience, and I try to capture that. But also, the football material in the book operates as sort of a political metaphor. When I was a freshman at Yale, the team was horrible. And my class of freshmen, there were 30 of us, many of whom had no business at Yale, but were decent football players, actually. So we staged a coup against the upperclassmen as freshmen and took over the team. And I write about us as being a we to come, that some collective trauma had transformed the nature of the collective itself, had created within a team of 120 people a team within a team, a we to come. And we went on to be the most successful class in a generation, won a championship, almost won a second. I think we're in a very similar moment here in America. There has been such a collective trauma to occur in my generation and beyond it. And I think we're in the early days of a beautiful and sort of dangerous revolution in terms of the ways we live in this world, in terms of the ways that we organize and participate in this society. And I think that revolution is starting on the inside, just as that football revolution started with 12 kids, you know, standing on the sidelines saying, wow, these upperclassmen really suck. We got to take their jobs. And I think some of that is happening at the political level in America. And I try to capture that in the book as well.
I want to talk about your mom. Before you knew anything about bipolar disorder, you have memories of her, I guess when you're just a really small kid, you have memories of her laughing and crying more than anybody else you knew for a longer duration. You remember her suffering a seizure driving you to school. How did you make sense of all that? And did anybody talk to you about it?
No. No one spoke to me about it. And, you know, one of the things people sometimes criticize me for about this book or in general, or tend to criticize writers for, is that, well, you don't have any solutions. Well, what's the alternative? And actually, I have a whole 9-page list of alternatives that I might publish at some point, one of which is to tell the truth to children.
Hmm.
When I was writing this book, my mother, who is such a magical and was such a magical creature, she disappeared when I was 13 and came back when I was 18. After, you know, in that time, I assume she was dead. So she sort of, I guess, raises herself from the dead and returns when I'm 18. But while I was writing this book, she started disappearing again. I mean, you know, mental illness is something that is so horribly addressed in our society, and so I've learned a lot from my mother about this. Anyway, when she started disappearing again, as I was writing this book, my niece was 12, and it was so heartbreaking to see her go through what I'd gone through at the same age, and be able to, even without her saying anything, kind of know. You know, she starts checking on people just out of the blue. You know, I mean, these very small things that on the surface don't seem particularly troubling, but I think I recognized in them so many of the ways that I tried to bring some order to the world when everything else seemed to be falling apart. And one of the things this book helped me to do was to actually have honest conversations with my niece about this very traumatic thing that was going on. First of all, to tell her that all of those negative things that she feels about my mother are totally fine and valid. You know, I have a whole paragraph in the book when my mother returns, and I say I wanted to disfigure her. You know, I had to be honest about that very raw negative hatred that I felt for this person who meant a great deal to me doing something really horrible. So that's the first thing I wanted to do with my niece and with other young people who are going through this. The nastiest, rawest feelings you have about these awful things, they're okay. One. Two. That's not the end of it, you see. You're not alone. There's something on the other side of that pain and that trauma. But third, and this is perhaps the most important thing, one of the most important things in this book and that I've learned, I had to write past my pain to see my mother as a human being, not as my employee. You see. And when I did that, I realized that the worst thing that ever happened to me was actually perhaps the most important thing that she ever did for herself. Right? She had to get away from all the stuff that was killing her. And I really do understand that. And so in some ways, I tell people, my mother reminds me a bit of Blanche DuBois from Streetcar Named Desire. I mean, she's really, I mean, if you meet her, she's a big star, man. She's great. But I couldn't just tell the story, nor should we tell any story, from one perspective. I had to tell the story of, here is a free person trying to figure out how to live in a world that calls them crazy and doesn't take them seriously and really kind of cuts them up and spits them out.
It's so interesting that you were able to get there, because no matter what, when your mother leaves and has any amount of volition in doing that, it's got to feel personal. It's got to feel like it was about you, even if it wasn't.
Well, I write in the book, if ever your mother asks you to choose between her death and disappearance, have her die, always, though not immediately, of course. And my editor, who is fantastic, I mean, she really... I thank God for her every day. She wanted to take that out. You know, she's a mother. She says, Casey, I think that's a bit harsh. I said, well, yeah, it is harsh. That's why I'm putting it in the book. It's also a good sentence, I hope. But, you know, death is clean, you know. There's an elegance to it, you know. I mean, it's very expensive. My aunt's a mortician, and my gosh, the rates they charge people to bury folks these days is absurd. But a death is clean, and a disappearance is a real cluster. And it creates this lingering sense of uncertainty that's still at 31 years old. You know, I went to therapy the other day, and my therapist was 5 minutes late and her name wasn't on the board. And I said, oh my God, she's taken my money and ran. You know, I mean, I still at 31 years old have this paranoia that everybody's going to leave. And it's going to take me a long time, perhaps anybody who experiences that a long time, to work through it.
My guest is Casey Gerald. We're talking about his memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Casey Gerald. He grew up in the Dallas neighborhood of Oak Cliff, earned a scholarship to Yale, then went on to get his MBA at Harvard Business School. And he's got a memoir out called There Will Be No Miracles Here. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Casey, it's apparent to anybody who reads your book, certainly, and even is listening to this interview, that you really love words and you love stringing words together. How did you and also your teachers come to understand that you had an amazing gift for public speaking?
There were two women that, in a lot of ways, saved my life. Gwendolyn Davis and Damaris Vance, who were my fifth grade teachers at Ariel Thorne Elementary School. Which I can still remember the school song. I think I'll sing it for anybody who pledges a lot of money to KRA. I
appreciate
personally.
That.
Yeah. I'm happy to support the cause. You know, my world was falling apart at home. And my response to that at 11, 12 was to try to eradicate all imperfections from myself. I remember when my mother started disappearing, my school was right up the street from my grandmother's house, and I'd walk the sidewalk squares, and my idea, it's a little sorcery, my idea was that if I walked the sidewalk squares perfectly and only put 1 foot in every square and never 2 feet, never put a foot on the cracks between the square, then when I got home, my mother would be there. And it worked once. And from then on, I said, oh man, all I got to do is be perfect. And I realized that around the same time that whenever I gave the adults in charge what they wanted from me, they liked me. And people might give me some food, and people might let me stay at their house. And so in some ways, I say that, you know, the muscle that you build in a way as a somewhat orphan is kind of the muscle of a whore. You know, I mean, you just give people whatever they want, which is very dangerous, but again, in our society, is very rewarded. We reward kids who submit. There was another kid in my class who also had some wild things going on in his life. His response was to lie down in the middle of Redbird Lane and wait for a car to run him over. Okay. Now, he was punished for this. He probably plied with ADD medicine, probably sent to the principal's office and paddled. We had corporal punishment in Texas in those days. Probably forced to repeat the fifth grade, while I, his mad, submissive counterpart, was told I had a gift. Well, every child has a gift. And I think one of the interventions that I'm trying to make with this book is to help kids not feel that they have to submit and conform to survive, and to warn those adults who are around and responsible for young people that actually the kid that is doing everything you're telling him or her to do, the kid that never seems to have anything going wrong, no sense of unbridled emotion at all the awful things that's happening, that actually is as much of a warning sign as, you know, my friend and classmate who lied down in the middle of the road and waited for a car to run him over at 11, which makes a lot more sense to me, looking back, than, you know, learning how to give a good speech. You know, I love language. But under every gift, under many gifts, is something actually a bit more troubling.
Today you say you can't decide if you love making speeches or you despise it. Where does that ambivalence come from?
It comes from the truth. You see, I mean, this goes a bit to the reason I started this book. You know, I had achieved by my late 20s everything a kid is supposed to achieve in America, but I was really cracked up. I mean, I wouldn't say I was having a nervous breakdown necessarily, but I wasn't too far off, and I was awful sad either way. And many of my friends were cracked up, and the world was cracked up too, so I set out to trace those cracks, you see. Now, the reason the book is so strange is because I felt it important that the words on the page reflect the wild, strange reality of human experience. I was listening to Eugene Peterson, the theologian, the other day, talk about why he loves the Psalms, and he praised the Psalms. I thought it was brilliant and beautiful. He said because David was willing to articulate the raw honesty of human experience. I don't know hardly anything that I'm not ambivalent about. You know, I mean, just this morning I made some tea and I wasn't sure if I wanted, you know, honey tea or green tea. I mean, you know, that's very quotidian. Mm-hmm. But I mean, seriously, the truth is ambivalent. And I think actually, if we could get more literature that especially nonfiction, personal narrative that reflects the strangeness and the rawness and the ambivalence and the chaos of real human experience, then maybe we would get to a little more understanding.
You worried in middle school and high school that being really good at football wasn't enough to divert attention from the fact that you were gay, but you don't use the word gay. You use a slur. Does that word reflect what you thought gay was at that point in your life?
You mean the word a faggot?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if y'all, I don't know if that's legal to say on NPR, sorry. On KERA. Give your contributions, people. Here's what I am doing with that language. I got a call from someone the other day who helped raise me and who means a great deal to me and who I know loves me. And she'd seen an interview I did on C-SPAN. There's a line in the book that says, I've been on this earth 30 years, now 31, and I've never met a single faggot, starting with myself, who survived without finding another place, real or imagined, to call home. Now, that's the truth, as I see it. Now, this person called and they said, hey, I saw your interview on C-SPAN, and I just had to tell you, you're a man. You're not a faggot. You're not a punk. And let me tell you what the difference is. You're prominent. You speak. You're intelligent. You dress well. People like you. You don't walk around doing your hand like that. You're not a vagabond in the street. You're an upstanding person who just happens to be gay. Don't put yourself over there when you're over here. Now, I was so grateful for this call because it was like hitting a gold mine. It is rare that somebody admits how they see you and how they see other people. What I'm doing with this book, and hopefully more importantly with my life, is putting myself over there, you see. Putting myself over there because that sense that this person had about the difference between a person who happens to be gay and a faggot is an act of violence. And if it's not an act of violence against me, it's an act of violence against the people that she does see as vagabonds on the street or people doing their hands like that or against the transgender women who are murdered at alarming rates every day. Either all of us are going to be faggots or none of us can be faggots. And that is something that in the language in this book, I try to bring worthy language to the beauty and challenge of loving another boy, in my case, in a society that hates faggots and teaches us to hate ourselves. And so I say after that line in the book that if that word seems harsh, it should. And I go on to explain why. So it's so important. I mean, especially in this moment of, you know, we've got an individual lead in the country who has such a dangerous willingness to let language loose for the most base, toxic purposes. I don't believe the response to that is to button language up just to make it seem like we're nobler people. I think the point of language is to let it all loose for the right reasons, not for the wrong reasons. And that's what I try to do with this very political, it's not just a linguistic intervention, it's a political intervention to put myself over there. okay? Because otherwise I'm complicit in the violence done on other people.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Muncy on the line in Dallas. Hi.
Hi. I want to say I love your show, Chris.
Thanks.
And thank you for having such moving authors on your show. Now, for your guest, I want to ask, you mentioned a very powerful line and said that in the disappearance, when it comes to mothers, it's easier to tell a child that your mother is or father has passed away than disappeared. What do you feel is it the same feeling that you have when one parent is incarcerated? And do you see any parallels in what you've been through and children of incarcerated parents?
Thanks for your call.
That's such a great question. Because I remember going to Lou Sterrett jail to visit my father. And I had to be very honest about this in the book. I had no interest at all in going to jail to visit anybody. I mean, you know, I've always felt it a bit strange that, you know, children are dragged down to jail like they've committed a crime or something. I mean, it's a very strange thing. I felt it was a strange thing for me as a kid. But it's a little different. I think the structural realities that lead to mass incarceration, which are so insane and not to mention arrayed against especially black people in this country. I mean, the structural realities are so clear. I mean, you can just go read Michelle Alexander and you know what actually is going on here, which is why one of the other alternatives that I have, you know, on this 9-page list is free everybody from jail. I mean, really, this is just, you know, if we really are talking about trying to get to justice, just let everybody out of jail, man. I mean, you know, that would be a lot more sensical than the inhumane approach we're taking now. But this is not a book about mass incarceration. It is a book about what it looks like to raise free, whole, healthy children. And I think it's very important. And I talk to a lot of friends of mine who have, you know, partners who are incarcerated and are raising children of those partners, to think about what the kid needs, not just think about what you want. And sometimes that's as simple as having a conversation. You know, a friend of mine who's actually asked her daughter, hey, do you want to go see your dad? And sometimes the girl says yes, sometimes the girl says no. I think that simple act of teaching children that they have a voice and including in that voice the simple phrase no, the simple act of refusal, I think that's a very radical and loving thing that we need to do more of for children.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, Casey, you mentioned earlier that when you got to Yale as a freshman, among some of the freshmen on the team were people who maybe had no business academically at Yale but were really good at football. You were academically qualified to go to Yale, but it took you a while to realize that you belonged there.
Well, it took me a long time to belong there. You see, my first year, I had an academic advisor who I probably would have dropped out without her. And I really appreciate so much of what she did, even if it had downsides. But she said, I had on a fitted hat when I went and met with her. And she said, well, take your hat off. And I said, okay. She says, do you wear those around campus? And I said, well, yeah. And she says, oh, no, Casey, you can't do that. It's just so, you know, stereotypical, whether she was talking about athletes or black people, whatever. She says, you're at Yale now. You don't have to do that anymore. The reality, and this is one of the big interventions of this book, is that the standard of success that we have in this society demands a sort of mutilation from so many people, young people, especially people from the right side of the tracks, places like Oak Cliff. I'm in L.A., so places like Compton. I go to New Orleans, places like the Lower Ninth Ward. Demands a sort of mutilation. Shortly after I started this book, one of my closest friends from Yale, a kid whose childhood had been much like mine, Hispanic kid, who was like a little brother to me and I'd helped recruit him, he took his own life. And not long after that, he came to me in a dream. And he was sitting in a booth in a in a diner. And I had gotten to the part of the book where I had to start writing about my time at Yale. And when I went there, there were posters put up in every school in Dallas that, with my face on it, that said, "Look who's going to Yale. He did it. You can too." And I was about to start writing about this, and I got so sad and I couldn't write, and I took a nap, aided by a little bourbon, which is like the writer's best friend. And my friend came to me in this dream, and he was sitting in this booth in this crowded diner, and he leaned back and he said, "You know, Casey, we did a lot of things that we wouldn't advise anybody we loved to do." And I knew exactly what he meant. I knew that if you look at it from the right angle, a boy picking himself up by his bootstraps looks just like a suicide. And I felt it my job in this book to confess, to make plain those things, and hopefully to keep some other young people, either young people in my generation or young people who are in elementary school today, from feeling that pressure to mutilate themselves, to put themselves in little boxes, to leave half of themselves at home and take half of themselves to Yale. You see, to feel that that bargain is worth it, and to really hopefully imagine what it looks like to truly live, you know, to be whole and free and have that sense of repair that so many of our institutions convince us is not even on the table.
My guest is author Casey Gerald. His memoir is called There Will Be No Miracles Here. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or go to Twitter and find us at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Casey Gerald about his memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So typically, Casey, when I come back, I will give a little summary of what the book is about. And I'm having a hard time sort of summarizing your life in just a few lines. I know what they say about you when you go to give a TED Talk. What is your one-sentence version of your life thus far?
Damn. That was it. Listen, you know, memoir is such an interesting term. My agent, Lynn Nesbitt, who I absolutely love, she has a friend who's a longtime Royal Victorian actor in London. And she gave him this book. And I met with him. And he said, "You know, when I was reading it, I didn't feel that I was reading a memoir. I felt that I was reading a history of America."
Hmm.
You see, and that is something that is very important. There is, without question, an extraordinary tradition of Black people telling personal narratives in this country that, you know, I read Frederick Douglass's narrative after I finished this, and this book is very different from that, obviously. I mean, in part because I wasn't a slave. But aside from that, the literary approach is very different. But it has been a profound miracle for black people to be able to tell their stories in this country as long as they have, and in ways that they have, and against the odds that they have. And I'm surely in that tradition. But this book is also more than a personal narrative. You know, I was at Lehman Brothers in 2008. I was in D.C. In the first years of the Obama administration. You know, I'd spent 3 years driving 50,000 miles across the country, going to places like Detroit and New Orleans and rural Montana and Appalachia. You know, I was in Berlin in the Stasi prison in 2009, 2010. You know, I've seen America from the very bottom to the very top. And this book is not just my personal story. It is a report back, hopefully as clinical as possible, with some entertainment value as well, a report back on how this country actually works in present and how we got to where we are now. I said yesterday that one of the things this book taught me was that you can't heal from it if you don't face it. That was so true as it pertained to my personal life, but it's also true as it pertains to this country. America, as I had when I started this book, has reached a dead end. Okay, and if we're going to go anywhere good from where we are now, which is hellaciously bad, then we had better get very serious about figuring out how we got here. And I think this book helps to do that in very important ways. I hope it does. And then, you know, we can put in the GPS. All right, here we are. And here's where we want to go. And hopefully that destination is a country that is fair and that is not aligned against the poor and against people of color and against women and against immigrants and against decency and against, you know, humanity. Hopefully we can get a country that lives up to the beautiful values that we've been so far from for so long.
Well, you've had the experience of sitting in a classroom surrounded by people for whom Notes of a Native Son came as a revelation, this book written in 1955, and this was just 10, 12, 14 years ago. It speaks to a really wide chasm between your own experience and the people you went to school with, because you say it was almost like reading old news. So what do you imagine people will take away from this book? What kind of people do you imagine are reading it?
You know, I'm supposed to sell the book now, you know, to a question like that is supposed to, you know, my immediate response was like, oh man, let's, you know, sell this thing. But I can't, you know, here's the reality, Chris. I mean, a book is not a McDonald's Happy Meal. You know, you don't go through the drive-through and come out on the other side and say, oh man, I got it. Oh, wow. You know, it makes total sense to me now. I mean, I'm still figuring out what the book means. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it takes sometimes the best books 100, 200, 400 years to see if they're really going to hold up. I'm going to be dead and gone, you see. But I do think, and I have seen in the meantime, that this book is like, you know, what did Jesus say? I'll be with you always, even to the ends of the earth. This book has started, it seems, to provide for people who have felt so alone in their lives and on their journeys, some sense that they're not alone, some sense that there is a way to truly live, to be whole, to be free, to be a better person, a better friend, a better lover, to know God for real, you know. It's a very spiritual experience. There's plenty to say in here about our current political moment. A friend of mine, Anand Giridharadas, who is one of the best journalists in the world, in my opinion, his new book, Winners Take All, is just such a vital book. But he says, you know, Casey, you're like Forrest Gump, but gayer, blacker, and smarter. And I said, I kind of like that. So, you know, if all you want is some entertainment value, then just think about Forrest Gump written by a black queer Texan with cameos by George Bush and Jesus and a lot of other folks. But if you've got a little more time and you sit with it, I think the book, as it does for me, is really a spiritual statement about what it means to live and what it means to live more abundantly, to keep stealing from Jesus's words.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Sonia on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Sonia.
Hi, Chris. I love your program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My question?
Mm-hmm.
I could be mistaken. I thought I heard Casey say, all truth is ambivalent. If he said that, will he use the words truth and reality synonymously? And if he still believes that, how does he even keep his head on from not going insane? And how does he decide that against which he might take a stand? Well, I can better understand that. It sounds like something Kelly Conway would say, but I thought I heard him say, all truth is ambivalent.
Thanks for your call.
Sonia, thank you for your call. You know, one of the things, and folks who know me well, that's a fantastic line, all truth is ambivalent. If I said it, I'm not sure that I meant to say it. But here's what I do know, and I think it's less about all truth being irrelevant. I don't mean it in the Trumpian sense, not to invoke that whole thing. What I mean is that we are less clear about what the truth is than we often think. You know, when I started to write this book, I was convinced that my mother disappeared when I was 12. And I was convinced that I felt certain things about that. Turns out, she disappeared when I was 13, and I had forgotten a whole year of her being around. And turns out that I had a whole other set of feelings about that that I had not engaged with or even known were there. And so, you know, my Toni Morrison often says to her students, you know, don't write what you know because you don't know nothing. And a lot of people take that as an attack against personal narrative. I think it's a great invitation, actually. We know so little of the truth about our lives, about our country, and it's a really beautiful and messy and ambivalent exercise to do the hard work of finding out that truth. And so that's what I mean in the non-soundbite version of all truth is ambivalent.
The God you were raised with wasn't okay with the fact that you are gay. What have you done with that, and how has your relationship to God changed?
Oh, wow. You know, I had to let go of the God that I was given to find the God I needed. I was raised, and I'm so grateful for my religious education. You know, the most important concept to me, it was hell, which was a very serious thing. I mean, it was like there was a tape recorder running at all times, recording everything I thought and said and did. And at the judgment, God would play the tape back, and whatever was on the tape, he'd listen to it, and then he'd say, all right, based on this evidence, you're either going to be up here with me in paradise, or you're going to burn forever and ever in a lake of fire. I mean, this was very real and material. Well, you know, in some ways, being a homosexual was a great gift here because there was no way to reconcile that. And I spent so much time of my youth trying to eradicate this gift, I call it, trying to ignore it, trying to act like it wasn't there. And it took such a toll on me that I wanted to die. I mean, I really wanted not to be alive. And so many queer people go through that experience of seeing no other way out of that than taking their lives. Well, I happened to decide in that moment at that time that I wasn't going to die in this life to avoid hell in the next one. I wasn't going to mutilate myself for God's love. Now, initially, I took the stance of kind of a spurned lover, you know, oh, to hell with him. I don't need him anyway. You know, I'm cool. I'm good. He's nothing to me. But that lasted for a few years of my early 20s. And then, you know, I describe it almost like Paul on the road to Damascus. I got so low in my life. And at the lowest point in my life, something grabbed me. Now, I call this thing God. But a friend of mine sent me a sermon by Frederick Buechner that said, if you really want to know God, assume you know nothing about God. And that makes total sense to me. So I know there is this thing that is supernatural, that I can't explain, but that is more real to me than all the people in my life. And this relationship with this mystery is the most important thing in my life. It's the reason I'm alive. It's the reason this book exists. And every day whether I'm praying, whether I'm reading the New Testament, whatever I'm doing, I'm trying to build this relationship with this stranger, and not out of fear of what's going to happen in the next life, but out of wonderment and gratitude and a sense of adventure of what this life could look like if I'm in touch with that entity that I call God. And I'm very grateful that I had to leave it for a while. I had to be apart from it for a while. I had to throw it overboard for a while so I could find it on my own terms.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's an interesting exercise to look at your life thus far before you even reach midlife. What do you want right now?
I had an interview the other day, and the interviewer said, well, what's next? You know, what are you working on? And I said, well, my number one priority is to be well. That's all I want. I mean, I think that's all anybody really wants. You know, I know so many people who have it all, who spent the last weekend at Oprah's villa, or who, you know, are working in the White House Situation Room, or, you know, running the World Bank. I know so many of these folks, and they are so sad and so miserable. The standard that we've set in this society is very strange, because it gives people a whole lot of things at the cost of themselves. So all I want to do is be well and have some peace and some joy, and to do good work that is the work that I'm led to do, and see what happens aside from that.
So is wellness a goal, or is it something that you're sort of abiding with now? Do you feel well?
Well, wellness is a way of being. A part of the way of being of wellness for me is to sort of get out of the mindset of goals, you know? So some of that is, you know, I was almost late to this interview because I had to sit in the bathroom and breathe for 3 minutes. You know, I mean, this was, you know, I mean, you know, it sounds kind of strange. And of course I have a luxury of doing that, because most jobs don't allow people to take 3 minutes to even eat a sandwich, let alone breathe. So, wellness for me is a way of being. A friend of mine told me it's a bit like, going through the grocery store, and the big question is, what are you going to put in your basket, and what are you going to take out of your basket? So I'm every toxic thing, every toxic person, every toxic piece of news, every toxic relationship, you see, every toxic idea about myself. I'm trying to take it the hell out of my basket, and I'm trying to put in a little silence, a little laughter, some real deep joy, some calmness, some good books, some good movies, some good food. You know, my grandmother's laugh, my niece, who's incredible. You know, I'm trying to put her in my basket. I mean, not physically, but you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
This is what I mean by a way of being.
Casey Gerald's memoir is called There Will Be No Miracles Here. Casey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you very much, Chris.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at K-E-R-A Think. My Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. We hope that you'll become subscribers to the Think podcast. You can do that by searching for K-E-R-A Think using any podcast app that you have on your phone or your computer. If you want to find out what we have for shows coming up, you can go to think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.